You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
Welcome back to the Classic Business Show, brought to you by Altron Technology Partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters. Now, corruption, we know, has become a virus that if left unchecked, will ravage and consume a previously healthy and functioning society. The big question now is how do we apply the medicine? How do we apply the chemotherapy to rid the body of the cancer of corruption? The Zondo Commission has certainly blown wide open the extent of corruption and state capture that we're facing. Daily reports of individuals being investigated, CFOs arrested or placed on leave. But it is a global phenomenon, and I thought it was quite interesting recently that we saw a PwC report reveal that more CEOs are being forced out for ethical lapses than financial performance in the year 2018. And it really dovetails with what I was chatting to Old Mutual's Robert Lewinson about ESG issues. This fight against corruption is also the center plank of the new broom, the new dawn, call it what you will, the winds of change. But what needs to be done to ensure that we close the back doors that were so brutally exposed by the last decade under the former president, Jacob Zuma? Well, to find out, we've established a formidable panel for you tonight to come and talk about the issue of corruption. Let's start to my immediate left, David Loxton of Africa Forensics and Cyber. No stranger to listeners, David. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much, Michael. Nice to be here.
Sandwiched between you and Nicolaas van Wyk is Terry Boysen, CEO of the CGF Research Institute. Terry, good to see you again as well.
As always, good to be here, Mike. Thank you.
And I've already revealed my third guest, Nicolaas van Wyk, the CEO of Cyber, the South African Institute of Business Accountants. Nicolaas, good to see you too.
Good evening. Nice to be here. Thank you.
I think the crisp question, David, to kick us off, is whether or not our anti-corruption policies and our procedures are adequate to inoculate against this virus or this cancer of corruption.
Michael, I think in my view, the laws, the legislation and regulations and the like, the policies, are actually very sound. It's the implementation where we are falling short. You know, internationally, we are recognized as having world-class legislation. Our Prevention and Combating Corrupt Activities Act is seen up there as amongst the best. You know, our Prevention and Organized Crime Act might be a bit dated, but you know, all these pieces of legislation, Financial Intelligence Center Act and the like, are strong, they're sound. What we've seen in the last 10 years or maybe even slightly longer is a whittling away of enforcement. And as good as legislation might be, it's useless if it's not actually implemented. So in my mind, we can't criticize the policies, procedures, processes, legislation. What we can criticize is the enforcement.
Terry, I see you sort of nodding in agreement.
Strongly agreeing.
And so expand on that for me. If it's the enforcement, where are we falling down? Is it the MPA? Is it the fact that we've not had the stomach to prosecute these cases, and the fact that the MPA has been so badly hollowed out? Is it the fact that we've had a culture of not wanting to blow the whistle, of being part of the system and not railing against something that's become so institutionalized, as we saw with the Basasa testimony, Agritsi saying he was groomed for this?
Yeah, I mean, I strongly concur with what Davis just said. The fact is there's almost a zero culture of accountability in our country, and sadly, I believe it's getting much worse. And of course, as we know, the leadership has got to set the tone and the example coming from the top. But that also being said, I think there's also a problem, a number of problems. One of transparency and being, willing to physically face the facts. I remember not that long ago, I was saying that, you know, in order to address the cancerous rot of our society, you know, if we were as regulators or regulator the only physician that could solve the cancerous rot, you know, would society allow us to cut long, hard, and deep? And of course, there's the deathly silence. I think it's the first problem is because we don't actually want to admit to perhaps, you know, how bad the problem is. And secondly, when we do kind of get half of an agreement, the focus to addressing the corruption is very narrow. So it was interesting hearing you talk about ESG, because, I mean, I've had a number of discussions around that, and that in itself is also a very narrow focus that is being used or probably exploited by some boards, where they really only address the environmental and the social issues in terms of corporate social responsibility.
But not the governance.
And then, Mike, it gets more interesting. And then they apply what I'm going to call a small g, a small governance issue, to the environmental and social issues, rather than a big G to all the components of the organization, starting from the board. So I really do think that the focus needs to change, and it's going to have to change from the top. And when I talk about the top, I talk about the presidency to start with, and that will need to be emulated through the leadership structures of organizations, period.
Nicholas, your opening comments, and also seen against this backdrop of the PwC study that more CEOs were forced out for ethical lapses than financial performance last year. This is a global study, so it just shows, yes, we have our own unique South Africa-specific issues when it comes to corruption and how endemic it is. But the fact is, across both the public and the private sector, this is a global phenomenon.
Yeah, we, Saibo, recently hosted an event called the Anti-Corrupt CFO. So our focus is on the role and function of CFOs when it comes to corruption. I agree with my colleagues that we have very strong legislation. We have all the right institutions to enforce the legislation. But maybe over the last couple of years, there's been a lack of leadership. And the CEO is, or the president of the country, he leads the country in decision-making. And society fits with what he sets as the example. That is not only relevant to the country, but also organizations. But what is bothering us is somebody signing the check. So we see the CEOs being accused and being held to account. But where's the CFOs? So we've all been really doing some introspection. We've all seen the scandals within the auditing and accounting professions. And of late, somebody signed the check at Eskom, and somebody signed the check at Busasa. So we would like to have a new focus on the role of the CFO. He's such a powerful individual. We really want to understand why they haven't stood up. And as CFOs obviously isn't the police force, and we're not the courts, but surely when we set up the accounting policies within the financial statements, we can make disclosures. That's within our power to do.
Well, internal auditors, external auditors, those are supposed to be the financial gatekeepers at the end of the day.
So the question, why isn't this happening? And from the conference, we've seen that it might sound like an excuse, but there's really bullying by CEOs of CFOs. And we need to address this. I don't think CFOs are necessarily emotionally smart enough to identify psychopaths within the business. And then I don't think they get enough support. So from the event we hosted, the feeling is that maybe we need a CFO legislation, a CFO act, that gives support to CFOs, gives them a structure to not only give a declaration within the financial statements, but if they decide to resign from a company based on what they've seen of corruption, they have to declare the reasons for their resignation. Mm. Have them, force them to do ethical courses every year. Force them to make these declarations and give them some kind of an official status. We know in the Companies Act there is company secretaries, to be very practical, and it's an office of a company to have a company secretary, but maybe give the same recognition to CFOs. Give them the status of an office, give them a little bit more independence, and have him make declarations. In that way, he can defend himself against the CEO, against manipulation, by saying that what the Companies Act required me to make this declaration.
Terry, do you go along with that? Are CFOs too isolated?
I'm not sure that's entirely necessary. In fact, I do believe that the structures are already in place. And yes, I half agree with some of the comments that Nicholas has mentioned, but I don't think we should lose focus of the Chief Audit Executive. And that person has a very unique functional reporting line where they report directly to the board. Functionally, of course, they report through to the head of audit and administratively to the CEO. And if that person had been given sufficient power, which I believe they have in the writings of the King Codes, and that they had been given the necessary mandates from the board, and that was all being done seriously, I don't think there's a requirement for writing new legislation or even for that matter new codes. I really just think, and I think I'll go along with the early comment from Dave, is that the rules and the laws, the so-called hard laws and soft laws, hard laws being legislation, soft laws being the internal laws of the organization, are in essence in place. It now requires us to act on that. And I don't believe that the boards have taken this seriously. So the consequences for non-performance of certain functions and duties, as well as crime and corruption, needs to now be sanctioned. That's what needs to happen. And that's got to come from the top. Simple.
Dave?
I tend to agree. As Nicholas was talking about new legislation, I was thinking, new legislation for what purpose? Because ultimately, if it's as a result of bullying, a CEO putting pressure on a CFO to be a creative accountant, surely your duty is to say, no,
yeah,
I'm not going to do it. And if you want to fire me, well, we'll play that particular scenario out. But I'm simply not going to do what you're asking me to do. It might sound trite sitting here in the cozy confines of your studios to say that, but I really believe that is the case. Whether one's a legal officer in a corporation, mm-hmm. whether one's even like a financial accountant being bullied by your boss to do something wrong, and I've seen it in clients of mine, and I've seen it in the law firms I've worked in, where junior people will actually say, no, this is actually wrong.
Yeah, it may sound trite, but it does actually go back to personal ethics, doesn't
Correct.
It, at the end of the day? And the Rudy Giuliani theory of really looking after the small things, the broken windows. And it starts with building that culture inside the organization. I do think a lot of that does rest on the CEO's shoulders. But there's another issue here as well, Nicholas, and that's IFRS. It's very complex. As a financial journalist, it's 650 pages long. It's peppered subjective judgments, loaded with jargon. It does seem open to abuse. Do we not need to be having a conversation around how open the system is to abuse in creative accounting?
No, exactly, and that brings the CFO's role again to light, and why I suggest there should be stronger legislation guiding them. If you think there's about, 300, 400 listed companies, and we've seen the Steinhoff collapse, and the damage that causes. So somebody is making a judgment call on how to interpret a set of financials and what to account for. And those judgment calls have real-life consequences, as we've seen. So the CFO, his role hasn't been enough, and I'm going to repeat that, focused within legislation. IFRS, I know we've adopted it, and most of the world has adopted it. But if you look at this very... a lot of academics still criticizing IFRS, especially in Europe and in Asia. If they adopt IFRS, they do it with exclusions or amendments. The US hasn't adopted it, and in some sense you can argue, given the difficult economic circumstances that the world is in, some countries are weaponizing IFRS to suit their economies. So we sit with a conundrum in South Africa. We want to be this example of applying financial reporting standards, but one, we may be losing competitiveness because other countries aren't applying it. They're twisting and tweaking it to suit their economies to look better. On the other hand, we're sitting with corrupt executives, adjusting them, as we've seen with Steinhoff, to mislead investors. So there's a serious question mark about IFRS and whether the judgment that, or the principle-based accounting is at all relevant.
And Barbara Curzon raised a very interesting question in MoneyWeb today, and it runs to this whole issue of, and Dave, you mentioned it, seeing a junior within a firm have the backbone to stand up to a senior executive. And accountants are now supposed to apply professional skepticism, whether they're working as an accountant or an auditor. Would a partner be comfortable if a young accountant disagreed with the manner in which a transaction has been treated by a company that happens to be a key client? What happens to those Chinese walls inside these firms? Will that young accountant be seen as obnoxious or troublesome? These are the real issues that confront the industry. There are a lot of inherent conflicts in the profession as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't disclose details, but I'm aware of a number of instances which fall squarely within the ambit you've just described, where you get an accounting firm with a great brand name not wanting to lose their key audit client. Mm. And when juniors have raised concerns about the ethics of certain methodologies and practices, they are simply told, suck it up, this is our best client.
Well, so that's the problem. How do we support, those juniors?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I can comment on this, so I think two new elements perhaps to this discussion is the element, firstly, of the lines of defense. As you would know, we've moved from three lines to six lines of defense. And if people, the listeners, aren't aware of it, I would suggest they go and read the King IV codes to understand those six lines of defense. And those six lines of defense are specifically put in place into an organization to further attempt, I guess, to preventing the kind of misconduct that we're talking about. So that would be, I suppose, something that definitely needs to be looked at. The other thing is, I don't want to just punt King as such. Other codes talk this stuff as well. But we talk about a governance framework. And the governance framework gives all key stakeholders access to the organization's horizontal and vertical governance instruments so that we get early warning signals to things that are going wrong, whether they're going wrong in the strategy of the organization, the operations, the legal, the compliance, doesn't matter what it is. And the problem here, Mike, is that we're not actually implementing a governance framework in these organizations. So one of the first and key questions that should have been asked of Marcus Hirst at the time was, please explain and show me where your governance framework is. And how was that governance framework ratified? And when was it ratified by the board? Now we can start changing the discussion, because now it's a collective accountability and liability, and any non-executive director who is not familiar with how that governance framework works and the transparency within that framework, including the documentation as verification, well, quite frankly, they must then suffer the consequences. We don't see that in organizations.
Nicolas, I see you don't agree.
No, I partly agree. The point is that Marcus Hirster, Steinhoff, as well as Bousasa, as was testified by Agrizi, had the best governance structures in place. They were following them. They had the ethical committees. They had all the best people on those committees. But was not being addressed two things in my mind. One, we're not addressing, well, the research shows that CEOs are percentage-wise much more likely to be psychopaths, or at least in the tendencies thereof. And then we've seen in our own country how one man can set up structures to suit him. And even now, after how many years, there's still no prosecution. So it can be manipulated, and it is being manipulated. So just having something on paper won't resolve anything.
And that's true. Sorry, I've got to say it. And that's true what Nicolas has just said. I'm not talking about, you know, governance as in codes and policies. I'm talking about a formalized governance structure that is codified in terms of combined assurance, whereby internal and external audit have to verify what's going on across all elements of the organization. I'm not referring simply to a code or policy. Yeah. So it's very different to what Nicolas has just said.
Yeah, very different from just having the glossy statements.
It's not the same, whether or not you actually live it.
Now, as we conclude, because we've had to delay our interview with African Bank, unfortunately, Dave, and we chatted about this the last time, in all your years as a lawyer specializing in these areas of fraud and anti-corruption, how seldom it has been that you've been approached by shareholders who've been blowing the whistle. And I want to come back to a story that was in Reuters today. It was on the wires earlier by an ex-Credit Suisse bank who's pleaded guilty to U.S. charges over that Mozambican loan. And it just shows you how U.S. law seems to breed accountability. And this is with regards to a Mozambican loan. It's very close to home. Yet we don't tend to see the same levels of accountability here. How can we start to improve accountability?
Michael, that's just, as we discussed on numerous occasions, very difficult question to answer, because it needs so many wholesale changes, starting with the tone from the top, starting with seeing people in orange overalls, in South Africa, so we see proper accountability in the sense that there are consequences for fraudulent misconduct. We need to see a change of approach across society. And as I mentioned before, one of my pet hobby horses is even in our schools, which encourage cheating. Turn a blind eye to the top rugby players taking steroids and the like.
I want to finish on the Steinhoff issue, because many academics, financial journalists, and asset managers I've spoken to point to a culture that's been bred inside a particular res at Stellenbosch University or at Vilkenhof, and it is a culture of omerta, almost, of not breaking ranks. And it is that culture, effectively, that needs to be broken if we're going to tackle this. I'm not so sure that any amount of new laws or legislation will change that particular culture that lies at the the root of the kind of corruption that we see rear its head. Unfortunately, chaps, that's all the time we have for. Thank you very much. Very stimulating and thought-provoking conversation tonight. Dave Loxton of Africa Forensics and Cyber, Terry Boysen, CEO of the Corporate Governance Framework Research Institute, and Nicolaas van Wyk, CEO of the South African Institute of Business Accountants.